Hello and welcome back to the first Tomahawk Nation Hoops Podcast edition of the new year, new decade. It is January 7th, 2020. I'm Matt Minnick, joined by Michael Rogner. Happy New Year to all of you out there. And apologies for our bit of sort of a lapse there between episodes. Michael Rogner had a little bit of a chest cold, caught whatever the flu thing going around out in California was. So he was not really able to, not at his best performance. And then between that and the family time, we just decided to take a little time off. So, but glad to be back. And we've got an exciting, I think, podcast lined up. Of course, everyone wants to talk about the huge Louisville win, and we will absolutely talk about that, including getting to the question of does Leonard Hamilton own Chris Mack? But we also want to we were going to talk a little bit about just look back at the decade that was, and really what maybe is the best decade in FSU basketball history. And then, of course, we'll preview the Wake Forest game that comes up tomorrow on Wednesday night. Michael, do you have a good New Year?
Well, it was a quiet New Year because I couldn't talk. But
I'm sure your wife loved that.
Yeah, it was great for her. Yeah. You know, so it's good to be back. You know, I got sick, but I battled, you know, took it one possession at a time, and here we are, ready to talk some hoops.
You got the heart of a champion, the true junkyard dog, hopefully immune system now in you for the rest of the year. We stayed with some family down outside the Ocala National Forest, which was great. Got to get away, no service, no nothing. Rode some four-wheelers and did some bonfires, so it was a good time too. But I am excited. Conference season is underway in full swing, and it's exciting about that. Exciting to dive into that. But first, let's look back at what was. Like we said, new decade here. So I'm just gonna ask you straight up, was the 2010 to 2019, right, the 20 teens there decade, so that would not include any result from this year, was that decade the best decade in the history of FSU basketball?
Oh, I like that question. So we were good this decade. We were good in the 90s, I guess, good and seven. So every other decade we're good.
Yeah, I feel like late 80s had a couple of good teams there with Mitchell Wiggins. Yeah.
Yeah, there might be an argument like the best 10-year period could have been like late 80s, early 90s, you know, right at the beginning of us joining the ACC. But anyway, I would say that for sure this is the best decade for FSU basketball. And I think the reason, so the 70s, you've got obviously the Final Four. But you also had some bad teams in there, and same thing with the 90s. Like we got off to a really good start in the ACC, and then reality hit, and we kind of stunk there at the end. And in this, you know, past decade, that I, for the most part, FSU has been really good, and the program is at a completely different level than it was, you know, kind of entering that decade.
Yeah, I'll hit you with some stats here first, and then maybe throw out an opinion. But so just in the last 10 years, six NCAA tournament appearances, that easily beats any of the previous. I think the 90s had four. And so that no losing seasons is a big one. And you kind of hit that too. I think this is the first decade since maybe this, I'd have to go back and look. The 90s definitely had a losing season. And the 2000s certainly had some losing seasons. So that's big. Three Sweet 16s, an Elite Eight, the first ever ACC championship, also played for another one, and set the school record for wins last year with 29. So I think I would agree with you. I'll throw a curveball at you that wasn't in the pre-write here. Which of the if the last decade was the best, if we agree that the last decade was the best overall single decade for FSU basketball, which team do you think you'd take on a neutral court against the others? Which FSU team?
Well, last year's team didn't make it as far as the previous years, but it would be last year's team, you know, especially if you could give me a healthy team.
Sure, I mean, all players healthy.
You know, Kofor, Fiondo, Trent, MJ, Terrence Mann. I mean, that was a really good team. And I think that if you talk to the coaches, they would also agree that that was the best team. And it just got completely derailed by Kofor's injuries and then, you know, personal problems with, you know, with losing a parent at a terrible time. You know, it was a really good team, and it's a shame that it kind of ended the way it did.
Yeah. No, I think I'm not going to say you're wrong. I'd love to hear maybe in the comments section, we could get some thoughts from other folks. I wonder, you know, the 2011 team also had, that was a Sweet 16 team that had Chris Singleton out for a long stretch of time. And he came back right for the NCAA tournament, but he was not himself. I mean, he was just not in the kind of shape that he was previously. I'm wondering if that 2011 team with that length and defense would have given last year's team's fits.
Yeah, that was that year that we Chris Singleton turned his head on the inbounds pass in VCU. True. Yeah, that was brutal. Yeah. I think that team just couldn't score. It had a defense which is, you know, one of the best defenses that has ever existed in college basketball. So that gives them a you know, one thing to hang their hat on. But
so they, ironic that they got beat on a layup.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and they just couldn't score.
Yeah. No, that's probably fair. Well, let's turn this into, and we could probably do this for the next few podcasts and tackle different subjects, but thinking about all of the great games, and for those of you out there, I actually wrote down a list of probably 15 games that happened between 2010 and 2019 that, you know, that folks might remember for one reason or another. Let's do a top three favorite of your top three and my top three favorite games that occurred last decade. The key word there is favorite. I don't, you know, it's pretty subjective. So it you could have that for any number of reasons. Doesn't necessarily have to be like the biggest upset or anything, but why don't you, what's your third ranked favorite win over the last decade?
Okay. So we're going backwards here.
Backwards. Yeah. Work our way up.
All right. So I'll take, the win over Gonzaga to make the Elite Eight. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't even that good of a game. It was just, we knew that we were going to win basically with 20 minutes to go. And you could just sit and enjoy it and realize that Florida State was going to the Elite Eight for the first time in a long time. And it was, yeah. So I'll take that one to start.
Yeah, no, I watched that one with some of y'all out there might know or have seen the work of Arya Masudi. You know, he used to work at Tomahawk Nation. He's now over at the Osceola and also with FSU Women's Hoops. He was actually at my house for that game. And I think the whole second, you're right, I think we just basically were high-fiving the whole second half. him, my wife, dog, everyone's just like up cheering. So that's certainly a good one. I considered that as well. I'm going to take number three. If you remember this one, it was Notre Dame, a really good Notre Dame team came to Tallahassee in 2017. And so this was the John Isaac team. And the game was just a barn burner. Florida State won, I think, 83-80. So Florida State won despite Notre Dame going 15 of 21 from three. To me, it really – I felt like that was we saw what the ceiling of that team could look like. Isaac was making plays, Bacon was making plays, a young Terrence Mann and Trent Forrest were on that team. And I think there was a late block by Isaac that really sealed the game out on the perimeter. And that it was just an exciting atmosphere. And we really saw like what that peak of Leonard Hamilton's kind of positionless style could be in that game.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I didn't see that answer coming from you. But I remember that it was also like one of the kind of earlier games that John Isaac became John Isaac. You know, it was like we knew how good he was, and then in that game, if I'm remembering right,
him and Bonzi Colson battled all day.
Yeah, he had he almost had a triple double. Like when you mix in blocks, like right. it was just a crazy good game by that guy.
Yeah. All right, number two.
Number two is, let's see here. What was my number two?
The, I think you mentioned something about the ACC.
Oh, yeah. It's hard not to think of that as number one. And I'm also thinking of it as kind of three games in one, but the, you know, we had three games in Atlanta in 2012 to win the ACC, went through Miami, Duke, and UNC, and they were all really good games, yeah. Especially that second game against Duke. I mean, that was just a total instant classic. And then North Carolina, we were able to just kind of hold them off the whole game. And, you know, that statement of going out and winning that tournament was just a program changer. And then also having it in Atlanta, I thought was great, because it's like, okay, here's what can happen if you get away from, you know, having all of the tournaments in North Carolina. And it kind of started a streak where other teams, you know, began to
that's right.
Exert right. themselves in the ACC.
There was like six in a row or something.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a great pick for sure. And could you really, I mean, is there a better path to win an ACC championship than beat Miami and then Duke and then UNC? I don't know. That's great. I'm going to go. So the game before your last choice there, the Gonzaga game, I'm going to say the Xavier comeback. And I loved your points about how just fun the Gonzaga game was. You know, the Xavier game was that roller coaster of emotions where, you know, you come in, they had beaten us the year before. They had, you know, killed us the year before. Now we were the prohibitive underdog. And for a while, it looked like they were killing us again. And then we sort of, you know, we made those, you know, second half adjustments and just crawled back into the game. And when PJ hit that three, I felt like that was we needed to get over the hump to make that, you know, what was the Sweet 16, and then of course make the Elite Eight after that. And I feel like we would look back at this last period of time, the last few years, differently had we had back-to-back second round losses to Xavier. So for me at number two, I've got the comeback and late victory over Xavier in the second round.
That was probably one of the, you know, if we were to make a list of like the five best basketball games, like if you just wanted them on
right,
you know, a DVD so you could watch them,
right,
or whatever people put those things on these days, you would have that game on there because it was just a brilliant
fantastic basketball game. We're up to number one here, and I got a hunch we might have the same one, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's Snare, you know, that game. So Snare hits the buzzer beater to beat Duke, and you know, the announcer goes bananas, and right. Not only was it, so I had a bunch of people over at my house for that game for whatever reason, and everybody was just going bananas, and it's probably like the single moment in my fandom, like I've been more excited while watching a sport event, but, you know, that's the moment. And you know, then it obviously all of the sort of ramifications it had for Florida State in terms of, like, okay, this
it really legitimized, like, our presence.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it has totally worked out. You know, looking back on it, it's easy to say that, but at the time it was like, okay, this is like, we're going somewhere.
It's also my number one. I 100% agree. I can tell you exactly where I was when he hit the shot. To your point, I think we were still that team that, like, oh, sure, they can, you know, upset folks at home, right? Like, yeah, if North Carolina or at the time Wake or Duke travels down to Tallahassee, you better have your guard up because they can pull the upset. But that was just a knockout heavyweight battle. I mean, if you recall, Austin Rivers hit what appeared to be a game-tying shot, the possession right before it. So this was not a game in which Duke played poorly. It was just a whale of a game with an even better finish. And I think it deserves number one. I had gotten to know, Mike Snare at that time period. He's a fantastic, human being, which no surprise for who Leonard Hamilton recruits. And, so I texted him a couple minutes, hours, whatever, after the game, probably just a one word, or something, you know, just like, congrats. And I think he got back to me maybe 3 or 4 days later that said, you know, sorry, bro, I had about 300 text messages from different people after that game, and I was just trying to get through all of them. And so you can imagine that it probably changed his life forever. So if you're listening, Mike Snare, tip of the cap for you. All right. So that was a fun segment. Maybe we'll do it again with different players or something coming up. Let's move into, instead of looking back the last decade, let's look back at the last week. Let's talk about the Louisville game. Let me just, we'll start off with this. Well, what went well? And because I don't think either of us or many people saw that outcome happening. What went well, and is it repeatable?
Yeah, I'm kind of glad we didn't record a pod before that game, because I would not have predicted Florida State to win.
I was hoping we could keep it within 10 and stay healthy. I think I typed that on Tomahawk Nation.
Yeah, exactly. But to get to your point, you know, what went well, obviously we shot the lights out, and that is not – it's going to be repeated a few games and you know, throughout the year, but we obviously can't expect to shoot 48%. But if you look at who was taking the shots, I think Forrest, Vassell, and MJ Walker took like almost 2/3 of the shots. They had 11 of 15 assists, you know, so they had the ball in their hands the whole game, and that's what this team needs. If we can kind of win on having a defense that is sort of, you know, not quite elite, but pretty close. And then an offense that, you know, obviously 10 or 11 guys are going to get involved. They're going to come in and wave. But when we get into half court sets, we need the ball in Trent's hand and Vassell and MJ Walker. We need those guys really being aggressive and ball dominant. And in this game, you know, we obviously knocked down the shots, but it was also the ball was in the hands of the right guys at the right time. And I think that is repeatable.
Yeah, I feel like it could have been both. I was going to say we talked about it on the very first podcast, Ep 1, or maybe it was in an article or some comment sections. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk about just the rotations. And this went back to me – this drove it home again that we've got to have MJ Walker, one of MJ Walker, Trent Forrest, or Devin Vassell on the court the entire time. Like, you don't necessarily need all three, but you cannot throw out a roster in ACC play without one of them. And so that, you know, you look back at the Pitt loss, MJ and Devin didn't even play the first half because of foul. They both picked up two fouls in the first 2 minutes. And then, of course, the Georgia Tech game that was maybe closer than it should have been throughout, although I don't know, perhaps Georgia Tech's getting better, or we'll talk about them in a bit. But, you know, when MJ missed, and you could just see what MJ missed the game, and you could see how that impacted who else had to be on the court and who had to, you know, basically Trent Forrest didn't get a breather in the Georgia Tech game. What did you think of him coming off the bench? What did you think of MJ Walker coming off the bench? I know that was probably for injury purposes, but is that a look that you liked so that he comes out there with the second group like Ian Miller did? He used to do.
Well, it's one game, and he played great coming off the bench, and so a lot of people are going to say, oh, he should come off the bench. But I was super thrilled to see him come off the bench, especially he comes in, and I think of that first shot was kind of like left corner, you know, like a 17 footer or something, and he drills it, and he just went bananas from there. So it was a hell of a game for Trent, but I'm not sold on him coming off the bench. I like to sort of maximize the experience level at the beginning of games and at the end of games. You know, I think that's when that pays off the most. And MJ is one of our most experienced guys. And so I think I'd rather see him out there, you know, kind of at the beginning of a game, and then, you know, have the, you know, the switch hitter be, you know, polite, or, you know, somebody who comes in and, you know, does something a little different.
Yeah. One more question on MJ, and then maybe we'll pivot here, but a couple of weeks ago, or the last time we talked about potential NBA prospects. I think both of us did not list MJ Walker in that surefire. I think I might have said that the way he looked against maybe it was North Florida or someone, like, oh, that was the first time walking out of Tuck. I thought to myself, wow, he could put himself on maybe a free agent map. Okay, so if MJ Walker played at anywhere close, like, obviously he's not going to go 5 for 7 from three, but let's say he went 3 for 7 from three the rest of the season and played like he did, does that change your opinion on whether he'd get a look from the NBA?
Yeah, well, I think the difference between MJ, the guy who's playing in China, and MJ, the guy who's playing in the NBA, is what we said, and that he needs to shoot like Malik Beasley.
Right,
and
he needs to be 42-43%.
Yeah, that's the one skill that's going to keep him out of the NBA. And so if he shoots anything like he did the other day, which was just full of confidence and they were going down, then yeah, I would go back and change my answer, because that what, you know, for 40 minutes against Louisville, he was an NBA player for sure.
I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, that reverse layup he made was was in control. You know, he there was no chance of a charge. He made the right move. I mean, going reverse was the right move in that situation with where the defender was. And then he made the shot. Like you said, for 40 minutes, he was an NBA player against Louisville. Is this the best, like, if we think about what Florida State, I mentioned the Notre Dame game, how in that John Isaac year, maybe that was like the peak of what that team was. Do you think that Florida State as a team could play better than what they just did against Louisville?
Offensively, I think that's about as good as it's going to look. They, you know, Louisville entered the game with the fifth ranked defense in the nation, I think, and we just totally torched them. Defensively, there were some issues for sure, especially in the first half. We kind of changed it up a little bit there in the second half. But defensively, I was actually a little disappointed in how we handled Louisville. And so we can definitely get better on that side of the ball. But you know, if we're shooting, you know, what we proved is if we're shooting the ball like that, then, you know, I don't see anybody, you know,
beating us. Of course, there's a lot of teams, probably. There's probably 20 teams that could say, well, if we shoot, you know, 11 of 23 or whatever from three, we're going to be pretty well. I will say that doesn't mean everything. Notre Dame shot 15 of 21 from us in 2017. It's a loss. So you do have to have the other side of the ball. What was your thoughts on the adjustments that Leonard Hamilton made at halftime? The defensive adjustments?
I think in our Slack chat there during the game, so Florida State comes out in the second half and is face guarding Nora, which is a much bigger adjustment than I think most people understand. I mean, it's a total change in the way that Florida State is defending things. And I wrote in the Slack chat that I just didn't know how I felt about that. And I meant it that way. Like I wasn't like, oh, that's a brilliant move, or oh, that's a terrible move. I just didn't really know what to think when we go into halftime up seven and come out of halftime doing things just completely different. It was a really big risk, I think.
Was it Vassell that was face guarding him for much of the early part of the first half or second half?
Yeah, Zach. Yeah, for the most part, it was Vassell and Chris Mack. Just he didn't really have any answers to it. It was weird. It was. And you know, if you take, not to get too down into the weeds here on X's and O's, but if you take Nwora and you put him on the wing and he's being face guarded, then Louisville knows that there's no help defense coming from that position. So there's a ton of things that they can do in order to utilize all that newfound space that's being created on the court. And aside from a few post moves or post entries to Enoch, he didn't really have anything. He didn't have any answers for it. And you know, luckily for Louisville, Noir is still good enough that he was able to score 11 in the half. But all of that was on, you know, offensive rebounds and broken plays and whatnot. So if I'm a Louisville fan, I'm a little concerned that Chris Mack was sort of handed a set of relatively easy adjustments and just didn't make any.
Does Hamilton and maybe Hamilton and Stan Jones, I mean, this is three games in a row. So he was the coach of the Xavier game where we made a big second half comeback. And then last year in what was essentially a coin flip coming into the game in terms of the odds, Florida State gets down double digits and makes a big comeback and wins, I think, in overtime. And then this year, really FSU controlled, I'd say, the last 25 minutes of the game. It was 27-22, and from there, Florida State, I guess, outscored Louisville by 18 over the last 25 minutes. Is it one of those situations where Leonard Hamilton and Stan Jones have figured out how to attack Chris Mack's kind of modified pack line defense?
Yeah, and I think if you go back to last year, you know, we were the last team to beat Virginia. You know, we've generally played okay against Virginia and now doing the same thing against Louisville. And they do a lot of the same things defensively. So, you know, it's definitely showing that the coaching staff can handle that sort of, like, you know, gap defense. And the shots that pack lines leave open are generally a lot of threes. And
you have to make them.
You have to make exactly. We made 11. But Louisville, you know, they made like 42% of their threes against us, and they got beat by double digits.
And took more free throws, made more free throws, and turned the ball. Florida State is turning over their AC. We've played four ACC games. Florida State's turning over their ACC opponents higher than 25% of possessions. That seems incredible.
It's crazy. And there was a question in one of the game or one of the threads on Tomahawk Nation the other day about, you know, why is Florida State so good this year? And part of it is just expectations. People's expectations were for Florida State to fall probably a lot farther than they really would. But the other thing is that Florida State has turned into just an absolute, totally elite team at turning the ball
it's
over on
defense. It's crazy. I mean, we're talking like peak press Virginia turnover rates for the defense.
Yeah, and it's unprecedented for a Leonard Hamilton defense to do that. So
for a team that's not really even full court press, I mean, I know we'll throw a token one out there, but that's not how we're doing it.
Right. It's just being long and being in the right place.
Yeah, and the non-steal percentage turnover rate is also – I know we'd rather have the live ball turnovers, but you get guys that are making a pass straight out of bounds and just looking at each other like they have no idea what is even happening, like what they're looking at on defense. Real quickly, and then we'll move on, but what is this – what does it mean for FSU's season – like – from the ACC perspective, I think this gives Florida State a real leg up. They're 3-1, and it looks like there's a whole lot of meh once you get past maybe UVA, you know, Duke, Louisville, FSU, UVA, and then a whole lot of meh. So I got to feel like, you know, we've almost locked into a bye, the top eight seeds, and maybe even a double bye. I don't know. I have to stay healthy. What does it mean for the season as a whole or the NCAA tournament resume?
Well, there's obviously a long way to go. I think for the ACC, it's a pretty clearly a three-horse race for those 2, 3, 4 seeds. I think Duke is a pretty safe bet to lock up the top seed. They have an easy schedule. They play Louisville, Florida State, and Virginia only one time each, I believe, and Florida State, Louisville, and Virginia all mix it up twice against each other. So, you know, those three teams have a much harder road, you know, to get through the ACC than Duke does. And Duke's just a really good team. So I think beating Louisville puts us in, you know, great position for that double bye. And, you know, we play Louisville one more time. So we can't say that we have the tiebreaker on them or anything. But, you know, if you can get into that, this is looking way ahead, but if you can get into that sort of 2-3 seed, if Duke's the one, that, you know, it's totally ideal.
Yeah. And the way I look at it, I think, is that we've just basically radically increased our margin for error, both in the ACC and the NCAA tournament. And not that I feel like the NCAA tournament bid is in doubt, probably only need to win another 6 games to make it. But a win at Louisville just really means that you can slip up somewhere else. And I wouldn't even say it washes out, because frankly, a win at Louisville probably is better than a loss. I don't know, even at Wake, you know, like, it's just, as long as you don't lose at home to Boston College, or lose at home to maybe, I don't know, Miami. Wake, Miami. Yeah. You've earned yourself an extra margin of error. We've got new decade, but same bills. So we're going to pay some bills and then come right back and talk a little bit about other things around the ACC and then turn our attention to the Wake Forest game. All right. We are back. We're back here. Let's do another, let's say 10 minutes here with this podcast. Let's talk a little bit, since we are into now fully fledged conference season, and there may be results happening on over the weekend or Monday, Tuesday nights that folks aren't, you're not able to catch every game all the time. So here's a few things that maybe caught my attention, and I'll get your take on them from around the ACC. Georgia Tech, who is now fully healthy, went into UNC and I mean, really made them quit, like absolutely obliterated them. It was, I believe, 27-4. At one point, and then possibly, I want to say, like 32-8, that I think UNC had more, they had no field goals in the first, like, 13 minutes of the game. No field goals, 9 turnovers. how bad is UNC without Cole Anthony?
Yeah, it's shocking. I mean, even without Cole Anthony, it's still shocking.
They still got four-star players healthy, even without Cole Anthony and without the other Anthony Harris that just tore his ACL.
Right. It's North Carolina. I mean, it's North Carolina. You should have the dudes to be a decent ACC team. I mean, if Michigan State loses a guy, like they don't suddenly go to the, you know, to the bottom, you know, third.
Kansas still win the Big 12.
Exactly. Kansas won the Big 12 1,000 years in a row, and that's dealt with a lot of injuries. So it's really shocking how bad things are right now in Chapel Hill. And I know it's Chapel Hill, so they'll get it turned around eventually. But it certainly doesn't look like – I mean, they could miss the NIT this year. They are so bad. And if Cole Anthony chooses to do the smart financial decision and just go straight to the NBA, then – Good Lord.
Yeah, you have to wonder what is going through his mind, you know? Like, on the one hand, you want to be there for your – you signed up for something, you committed, you want to be there for your teammates. But on the other hand, like, if they get to where they are, I don't know, 8-8 or 9-7, like, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, that's – I definitely do feel for the kid. I've never been in a position where I have to make a decision – you know, based on, you know, tens and, you know, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars. But he's been a good enough player for long enough that I'm sure he's thought about these things. He's got a dad who was, you know, all over the, or I guess a father who was all over the NBA. So this is a position that he's probably thought about basketball as a business, you know, a little more than the average player.
Sure.
And so at this point, I'd be a little surprised if he does come back. But like any athlete, any competitor, I'm sure he's just burning to be out there with his guys.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I watched – he was there on the sideline cheering him on as I watched the total debacle. I don't know. I don't even know what to make of UNC right now. Let's stay in the Triangle area. North Carolina State they already lost to Georgia Tech at home just to kick off the ACC season. And that was when Georgia Tech didn't have half their players that they've just got back from injury or transfer. Clemson, who previously was 6-7 on the season, although also now getting healthier, came into Raleigh and really just kind of controlled the game from start to finish. Is this a sign that Clemson is just better now that they're a bit healthier? Or, you know, we saw Kevin Keats's team, they won with 3-point shooting at UNC Wilmington. They weren't a great defensive team, but not a ton of mid-majors are. They haven't been a great defensive team since he came to Raleigh. Is he another Mark Gottfried where his teams just don't defend?
Yeah, I think until he proves otherwise, you have to go with that assumption. They weren't good either of the last couple of years, NC State's defense, and they're not any good this year. Clemson, you know, I think we talked about this on one of the earlier pods, is that they're going to be a team that is consistently getting better throughout the year, and they're going to be way better at the end of the year than they are at the beginning. You know, I don't know if that's going to be good enough to get them into the NIT or not, but yeah, they're definitely going to they are better, and they're going to continue to get better.
So FSU owns double-digit wins over both Georgia Tech and Clemson. I guess it's possible. It sounds like that those might look a tad bit better 3-4 weeks from now than they maybe we thought they would at first. UVA and Virginia Tech, talk about struggling to score. VT only managed 39 against Tony Bennett's pack line. Is Braxton Key is back. He is healthy. He threw down a monster jam the other day. If folks saw it, one-handed putback where he kind of soared in from out of nowhere. Is UVA just turning the corner maybe with Braxton Key and getting better? Or is it the VT team that we saw beat Michigan State, you know, now they're 20 games into the season and their lack of depth and their reliance on freshmen like Landers Nolley, that's just starting to catch up to them?
Yeah, I'm not ready to change my attitude yet on Virginia. I mean, they were just a few days removed of barely beating Navy, and then, you know, they got spanked by South Carolina before that. Virginia Tech, I think we said we were going to revisit them in January, mm-hmm. February. So I guess it's time to revisit them, and yeah, they're not what – they beat Michigan State, and everybody got super excited, and then they, you know, had three games in a row against sort of border, you know, two elite teams and one really good team that they lost. And now it's time to, you know, the rubber's going to hit the road. And I think because the ACC is down, they're going to, you know, they're going to have a decent year and they're going to end up in the postseason somewhere. It's not going to be the NCAA tournament, but
yeah, I think you're right. I, you know, in September, I had pegged Virginia Tech for possibly 2-18. I thought they could be the second 18 loss team in ACC history only because Pitt managed to go 0-18. But I don't know that they're going to go 2-18 because, like you said, they're probably going to find ways to win against the BCs and Miamis and maybe Clemson or UNCs of the world. But I agree that they are finding out what life is like when you don't have 10 ACC caliber players or even 8 ACC caliber players.
And every ACC team already has a win. So there's not going to be a, so Pitt and BC are still kind of on the hook as, as the last winless teams.
Yeah. One other one real quick, Wendell Moore for Duke, who I think he was only their probably third best five-star freshman. But Wendell Moore broke his hand or a bone in his hand and is out indefinitely per Coach K. Does that change them at all, or just something that, you know, Duke has to deal with for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, they'll be fine. I mean, of the four freshmen, he's probably the one they can most afford to lose. And, you know, baseball has that value over replacement player stat or whatever. And so they're losing Wendell Moore, which means that somebody like, you know, Alex O'Connell is going to get a lot more minutes or something. So it's not like it would be like Florida State losing somebody and then saying, oh, but we have this guy named MJ Walker on the bench. I guess he has to play now, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Now I to me, the two injuries that would like significantly change the outlook that I have for Duke would be Trey Jones or Vernon Carey. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, we play Wake Forest here tomorrow. I joked in the comment section that with the incredible upheaval that seems constant in this year's college basketball landscape, for those who haven't been following, top 10 teams are just drop like flies. I think there's been 6 or 7 different number ones, and unranked teams beat top 5 teams like it's nothing. And so Florida State has entered the realm of the top 10 this year. They are 10th in both polls, and they travel up to a not untalented Wake Forest team. What do you see? What's the range of possibilities here?
Well, I think the upset comes from the refs, and I don't mean that the refs are going to throw the game or do more bad calls than we should expect, but it's going to come in how they call the game. If we get calls like if the game gets reffed like Florida State Louisville. If every game for the rest of the year gets ref like that, Florida State's a 1 seed or a 2 seed. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to allow a hyper aggressive defense to kind of put their hands on guys, and you're not going to just blow a whistle every time anybody looks at anybody, then, you know, Florida State's a totally different team. And Wake Forest is really good at getting to the line. It's basically like the only thing they do well. So it's going to come down to, you know, how the refs call the game and you know how aggressive that allows us to be.
Yeah, I think that's a great shout out. We had an interesting dialogue in the Slack channel, you and me and Josh, just that, you know, look, no team likes to put the other team on the free throw line. Let's just throw that out there, right? Like, no one wants foul trouble and no one wants the other team getting free points with the clock stopped. I think with Florida State, there is an increased adverse effect to Florida State when there is a quick whistle, because two of the things that Florida State really relies on to win games, number one is turning teams over. And so we do that very well with defense. If we're fouling or getting called for fouls and putting them on the line, well, that's a possession where there was not a chance to turn them over and generate the fast break, easy offense the other way. Number two, you know, we win by grinding teams down. We, you know, time and time again, it's you get to that 10-minute mark of the second half, maybe it's a 3 or 4 point game, it becomes a 12-point game quite simply because we've just worn out others both physically and mentally. And when you're stopping the game constantly for fouls, when you're not having to force an offense to execute through that just mentally exhausting frustration of having to swat the gnats and mosquitoes away that is the Florida State perimeter defenders. And when our guys are getting in foul trouble, you know, you're taking away that depth and that kind of like grind you down mentality that we thrive on. And so I agree that a game that is called with a quick whistle does not favor Florida State. Are there any particular players that scare you on Wake Forest?
Brandon Childress is kind of that classic small point guard who's going to be able to dribble right by most of our guys. And then that creates some problems on the perimeter. They don't shoot a ton of threes. They're a decent shooting team. You know, they'd certainly have some guys who can hurt us. And then they have what's his name? Olivier Saar, who's a really interesting guy. He's a junior now, so we've seen him before. And he's this French 7-footer, and he's having a really good year. He's great rebounder. He's drawn a lot of fouls. He's blocking shots. You know, so it gives a lot of teams these days don't have really effective 7-footers, and so it gives us sort of an interesting matchup to watch, because they do have this big guy who can actually play. And so it'll be interesting to see, it can also go at all, is Dom going to be effective against, a 7-footer, be able to stop them, or can we guard them? Can we go small, and still be able to stop them just pumping it into the post for fouls?
Yeah. No, great stuff. Michael Rogner will have more, a preview of the game as well, I'm sure, tomorrow before the game. So head over to Tomahawk Nation or at Michael Rogner for the link to the preview. Let's get a prediction then. And so Wake just actually went up to Pitt over the weekend and got a win in Pitt, which is something Florida State couldn't do. I don't know. I don't like to play the transitive property game, certainly not in basketball, but worth noting that Wake is coming off a win. Do you have what's your prediction for the game?
I think we're going to be able to rattle a few of their guys, and I think that it'll be enough. I don't really see us going in there and blowing anybody out. Like Louisville, we beat them by 13. I don't really see us beating Wake by that much, but I'll say Florida State 70 and Wake 62.
Okay. I do not think we're going to shoot as well. I just don't think we're that good of a shooting team. I would say we're not as bad as we looked that first half against South Florida. But I just don't think we're as good of a shooting team as we looked against Louisville. I think we'll regress to the mean a bit there. So I'll say maybe trailing by one at the half and come back, wear them out with our pressure, a perimeter pressure, and let's say a 71-67 victory. So I'll say slightly closer than you, but roughly the same scoring range.
All right.
Well, you can, bet those if you want, take them to the bank or don't. we look forward to another game tomorrow and another episode hopefully later this week. Happy New Year, everybody, and talk soon.